The following program brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities. The opinions expressed by the members of CFCI and their guests should not be construed as specific investment, legal, or tax advice. All economic and performance information is historical and not indicative of future results. Investing may involve the risk of loss of principal, and any tax advice on the show is not intended to be used by any persons for the purpose of avoiding U.S. federal or state tax. Penalties that may be imposed on such persons and each listener should seek advice from their tax advisor or legal counsel on topics that arise from the show. The representatives of CFCI and their guests are not providing legal or tax advice, and nothing should be construed as a solicitation to offer or buy securities. Now enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, welcome to the big show, Your Money with David Hayes. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. Doug Hughes is in the house once again this week. Hello, Doug.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. It's been a whirlwind of a week.
Did you
watch the presidential debate?
I did.
We haven't had a lot of time to discuss this in detail. I don't think it changed anyone's mind. I don't think that anyone watched that. And although they did say across all networks, it was a pretty highly watched event.
Very highly watched.
Good. I think that's good.
Yeah. I think, as I heard one commentator said, the undecideds, the independents, as they call them, there's maybe 10% of them with the people watching were that way, and maybe 30% were maybe tilted towards Vice President Harris due to her really good performance. But the other 70%, there's no detail there. And I think that there are some very serious questions that people have that need to be addressed that are going to be, the old substance over style. And so I think that we'll see if they debate again. But I think she'll get a bump like all people do when they have a good debate. But I think nobody's mind was really changed.
I mean, their playbook is to not communicate with them and with the Trump side, and it's worked so far. And if she had a good performance, and everyone says she did. Like you said, what is performance? It is a performance, right?
Yeah.
Maybe not like you said, a lot of substance. But anyway, why would you go back to the well if you already did what you needed to do? Show something. So we'll see how it all goes, but. We've never talked politics on this show and taking a side, one side or another. I just like keeping people wondering, what Hayes really think. We're always like, we're not about the red, we're not about the blue, we're about the green, right? We're talking about moolah here.
Yes.
And I know I can tell you that questions about what do you think is going to happen? It happens every single time. Election years, particularly presidential elections, they traditionally come into focus after Labor Day. I would say in this case, probably came into focus a little bit sooner than that. But with that said, we just had the first quote debate. So it's kind of when Americans begin to become fully engaged with the process. With that in mind, we get these questions all the time. Politics aside, again, it's about the green. Which way is best for my bottom line? And it's a fair question. And I'm going to offer you a very fair answer. Would you believe there's not much of a difference? In fact, the best average annual returns come in periods when one party is in the executive branch while the other party holds the reins of one or both bodies of Congress. Now, of course, we can't tell you that that's always going to happen, but historically that's what's happened. But so why is that? Well, maybe the system works best when a diverse group of ideas meet face-to-face and come to some compromise, right? Or maybe not. Or maybe nothing happens. Sometimes the government doing nothing is actually very helpful. Or maybe Wall Street has learned how to adapt to the goings of the District of Columbia. And you may be incredibly passionate, as I know many of you are, about the election's outcome. It goes beyond the White House, too. There's 34 Senate seats available. And every go-around, 435 seats in the House. And a wide variety of state and local issues on the ballot this year. And guys, voting is the pillar of this country. Everyone I know votes.
Mm-hmm.
And my son, he learned how much pride he should take in the right to vote. But unfortunately, I still know people that say that I don't, and I say no, friends of mine, people I work with, they all vote. But I still know people just don't vote. They don't think their vote matters. Guys, your vote matters, especially in these city elections and county elections when we have such poor turnout. Now, thankfully, during a presidential election, we typically get bigger turnouts. So I'm sure many of you out there, because you're highly educated and thoughtful and caring people because you listen to this program, are reading up and making careful choices about not just the nation's future, but the future of your state, your city, your county. So here's the thing. When it comes to being in the financial world, like Doug and I are, when we work on a financial strategy, we make it to consider major and minor events. We prepare for volatile periods. No matter the outcome, keep your focus. Keep your investing focus as the election approaches, and try to avoid overreacting because we will have some short-term market volatility. Doug, your thoughts before we go to a break?
Well, I've been through 7 presidential elections so far in my career, and they all end up being about the same finger pointing back and forth. It's the end of the world, the end of the economy, all these different things. And you know what, folks? It hasn't been so far. And so I do think that where we are underserved as a nation is when you go back to the 2000 debates, the word terrorism never even came up. And yet we had September 11th, which
the debate was on September 10th, and nothing
was said about that. Not one moment was spent on the national debt, which I thought was a disaster because that is facing us.
Right.
And so, you know, these debates and different things as we go through these elections, sadly, we aren't always getting answers on big things that are potential risks. And it just gets kind of narrowed down to a few items that are gotcha moments,
right,
as opposed to bigger discussions about the future. And I think, you know, that's why you get so
so you have to trust somebody, right?
Yes.
So when they say, I have a plan for this, just trust me. I have a plan for that, just trust me. I think if someone stood up, and I would love to do the debates, but I can't afford the pay cut. You get paid a lot off the record somehow, some way when you're in Washington because the stated salary.
It's a little bit different.
But it's something like, you know, it's like, do you guys realize that we have 100% debt to GDP ratio? Do you know what that means? Do you know the last time we were in this debacle, how we got out of it? Did you know that no country ever survived when they were spending more on the interest on their debt than they were on defense of their country and their allies? And smack them in the face with it, right? And then say, I am going to address and fix this problem. Did you know the Social Security Trust Fund is going to run out in the next, you know, whatever, 10 years? I'm going to address that issue. And you just hammer. Because when you think about who's voting, the biggest voting block is the baby boomers. And that's what they care about, right?
Yep.
They care
Absolutely.
About that. Sure, inflation. Sure, you know, the stability of the financial markets. Sure, secure borders. All that is super important. But, you know, just say it. Be bold. You know, be bold and say, I'm going to fix it. How are you going to fix it, Dave? I don't know yet, but I'm going to circle myself with the smartest and greatest people in this country and maybe the world, and we're going to address these issues.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm not running, folks, so don't write me in, please. Don't write me in. All right, when we come back, let's talk about market returns in past election years. I think it's pretty interesting. We're going to buzz through that. We'll be right back at Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Questions, and hopefully we have answers. You know, emails, you know, text messaging, whatever it is. What do you think? Should I do this? Should I do that? I'm going to talk to you about, Doug and I are going to talk to you about performance in past election years. So here's the very first thing. Returns have been positive in most election years. The stock market has been positive in the majority of years, including election years. The election years when the S&P 500 posted a negative return, 1932, 2000, and 2008. What is the common theme there? They're all associated with recessions. We had the big tech bubble burst in 2000. That we had the major recession, almost depression in 2008. Of course, everyone knows what was happening in 1932 during the Great Depression. So that's lesson number one. Number two, returns have been positive in the second half of 14 of the last 16 election years. So the stock market's been positive in the second half of most election years. The S&P index posted a median gain of 5.5% in the second half of the election years. That's on average. The election year, which is the S&P 500, that's what we're going on here. And you might say, well, Dave, you've been telling us not to just put all our eggs in the S&P 500 basket. Hey, go with me on this one, because the S&P, for all of these years, haven't had such a massive cap-weighted lopsidedness. So just stick with me on this. The election years in which the S&P 500 posted a negative second half, guess what? 2000, 2008. Again, both recessions. Markets were generally range-bound during the 3 months before an election. We're seeing that now. Market and election years have, on average, posted gains in the second and fourth quarter of the year while trading sideways in September and October. Remember what? Remember August? That wasn't very fun. Market volatility in past election years. Election or not, volatility has tended to increase in late summer, early fall. Volatility since 1960 tended to be higher in September, October, and November. That has been the case in both election years and non-election years. Are you getting a theme here? It's kind of saying it doesn't really matter. Recessions, again, not elections, they cause higher volatility. The market hasn't been more volatile the month of an election than any other month. The market, as known as the VIX, the volatility index, has been below or near long-term averages during six of the past eight election months. Volatility is meaningful above average in November of 2000 and in 2008, right? So those, again, both associated with recessions. Recessions, not elections, cause higher volatility. What is a potential indicator of election results? And this is when I think it gets pretty interesting. Market has performed better before elections if the incumbent party ultimately wins. Here's the thing. Who's the incumbent, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have one.
We don't have one.
We don't have an incumbent. You could say, well, it's the ticket. But no, the vice presidents rarely matter. Rarely mm-hmm. have they mattered. You do not vote for Trump because he picked J.D. Vance. You're not going to vote for Kamala because of Waltz. You're not going to do it.
Mm-mm.
You're voting for Trump or you're voting for Kamala. Now, that this misery index we're going to talk about, so it's kind of like, well, we're going to talk about that next. But, okay, so we can't really go off of that one. So markets have performed better before an election if an incumbent party ultimately wins. You could argue Trump would be the most close to an incumbent only because he's served before, but I don't know. So this thing called the misery index, Doug, has tended to be a decent predictor of incumbent success. And again, because we don't have an incumbent, the most decent predictor of results in an election have been this. It's when you have inflation plus unemployment. That's what they call the misery index. And it's kind of held solid during this period. And I'm just saying currently the misery index may not be particularly helpful because, one, we don't have an incumbent. Two, it's essentially flat the past year because unemployment rates have risen a little bit and inflation has fallen. So the plus-plus thing has stayed pretty flat. So I don't think even if we had a true incumbent that we could indicate that the misery index has tended to be a decent predictor of incumbent success. So I don't know. That one's going to be an interesting one for sure. The last thing I'll say is everyone's like, well, the Fed's going to be moving rates in September and blah, blah, blah. Well, here's the thing. The Federal Reserve has made moves in election years. And contrary to popular belief, it's not unusual for the Federal Reserve to adjust monetary policy during a presidential election year. When it did, the incumbent party has lost more than half the time. Now, why is that? Well, think about it. Why would they be cutting interest rates? Because the economy stinks, mm-hmm. right? And people vote with their pocketbooks. This is likely because changes in monetary policy often stem from worsening economic conditions, including slow growth and or rising inflation, almost always. And that's why during 2020, I was like, there's no way Trump's going to lose because the economy's great. You know, I joked when we went into the short recession mm-hmm. during COVID. I'm like, we were like a fat man going into surgery. We had a lot to lose. So mm-hmm. we were going to be just fine. And we were just fine. But I said, there's no way. I've never seen it happen. I've never seen a situation where you're in the middle of a conflict or a serious war where the executive branch changes. Great economies, it doesn't change. And lo and behold, it changed,
mm-hmm.
right? So
it did.
That's what I mean. These are just kind of ballpark guidelines, things to watch. Bottom line is, folks, want to hammer home, it really usually doesn't matter. So don't make any drastic decisions. I'm getting all out in cash till after the election. That's the worst thing you can do. You never know what's going to happen, right? You never know. So, Doug, like you said, you've been through seven of these in your career.
I've been through seven of these, and it goes back to wide diversification. If you are that concerned about the markets or the election, then maybe it's a time to review your asset allocation and to your diversification and take a step back and say, okay, if I'm too heavily overweighted in one thing, and I think and we always throw this term out, the stock market. If the stock market goes down, maybe you can reallocate to something else. But to your point, David, most people don't know when to get back in to take advantage of the increase or the climb back up in the equity markets. And so that's where the biggest mistakes are made is, hey, I'm nervous, so I'm getting out. But then by the time confidence comes around to get back in, it's typically too late to get back in. And so, maybe it is that you should pull back the risk tolerance all along the way, and you will stay invested for longer periods of time without knee-jerk reactions.
I went back and pulled something. Exiting the market in the second half of an election year has not been a good strategy. Here's an S&P 500 growth of $100,000 invested in 1957. Now, you're better off staying the course than you are adjusting your portfolio based on a political calendar. In this hypothetical buy and hold strategy that I pulled up, the S&P 500 since 1957 would have meaningfully outperformed a strategy that the investor removed their money from the market for the second half of each election year. In fact, that $100,000, if you would have done that, would have still grown to $6.8 million. But if you just left it in during that period of time, your portfolio was $12.2 million. Case closed. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, one of the things that will help you moderate your portfolio is determining what are your expenses, especially in retirement. If you're still working, you're 40, 50, whatever, don't worry about it. I don't want anyone to worry about it. But if you're someone that's leaning into your investments for income in retirement, a way to manage that risk would be to match up your expenses with your investment strategy. We'll be right back. It's Your Money with David Hayes. Doug and I are both taking off for our big broker-dealer conference in Austin, Texas. We leave tomorrow morning. They bring the big dogs down early. They call us VIPs, but I call us big dogs. And then the minions come in around Sunday night. And then we all join forces, and we'll be back in town Wednesday. So I'm actually going to come in here on Wednesday and record the question and answer show with Jim Inman Jr., on Wednesday, but it'll still play on Thursday, because then I turn right back around and go on this long planned trip to Tanzania, and I'm going to be fishing for tiger fish, fly fishing. We will be tent camping in three different camps, and we will be driving Jeeps between camps through refuges. So we'll be seeing hopefully some animals as well. So
wow.
Fishing
the big
safari.
Five? Are you going for the big five? Like the water buffalo, the elephant, the lion, the... Forget what the other three are. Zebra,
well,
maybe?
This is a camera shooting event, not a gun
shooting
event.
Well, no, but I mean, are they saying
you know what?
See the big five?
Because we're not going to do like an official safari, it's going to be traveling from one camp to another camp, which may be two or three, 4 hours away by Jeep.
So and just potential you might see.
Potentially, something. They said they will take a course which would likely let us see some pretty cool things. So
nice.
I'm trying to keep my expectations reasonably low.
Yeah.
But I did just find out when I got the itinerary, because I had to have so much stuff, guys, shots and visas and blah, blah, blah. And anyway, I just found out that we will be sleeping in tents.
Nice.
So,
nice. Yeah. Hopefully there'll be some big nets.
Ah, geez. Yeah. Yeah. So I have this big, crazy week and a half of things going on. So with that said, the week I'm gone, Jim's working with Doug and the gang to come up with a really great show for that week when I'm absent. And then when I come back, I'll share some thoughts about how the entire trip went. And it's funny because a lot of times when I talk about that stuff, I'll get more emails about what did I do, where did I stay, mm-hmm. who helped me arrange the trip, than about the kind of stuff we're talking about now,
right,
about
right.
election years and whatever. All right, so let's talk about – go ahead.
People, we've said oftentimes on the program that people spend more time planning their next vacation than they do their retirement.
Or fill in the blank, right, when it comes to this kind of stuff. I mean, the bottom line, folks, it's so much easier going up the mountain than it is down the mountain. You know, going up the mountain, you're just saving for retirement. You're diversifying. You're automatically saving. General sense of when your retirement date's going to be, but maybe not exact. Then you get to the point of decision-making. Rubber meets the road, and it's like, okay, what do I do? Do I annuitize some of my money or not? What's my concerns or what they should be around longevity? And, of course, you know me, longevity is that great risk multiplier. The longer you live, a lot of things can go great and a lot of things can go wrong. How much should I withdraw? How much and from which accounts? When do I claim Social Security, right? What about inflation? Is inflation across the board? No. You know what? There's sometimes inflation comes down. I actually was, where we were buying a new laptop for someone at the office, and I'm not really involved in that very often, and someone mentioned it, and I said, what is a laptop now, like $1,200, $1,500? And he goes, oh, no, you can get a really good one for like $500.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I remember when laptops first came out.
Sure.
20 years ago, you're paying $3,000 for them. So certain things do come down in cost. Healthcare, right? That typically trends much higher than your traditional discretionary spending or your necessity spending, because I think all three of those have a little different inflation path. Healthcare, you know, it might track at 5. Your typical everyday stuff, your gas, you know, your transportation, all that stuff, your roof over your head, it probably tracks at traditional inflation more like 2 to 2.5%. Discretionary, you know, I think life has a way of moving that needle, because when you are in your go-go years, you're spending more money. Slow-go years, you don't spend as much. No-go years, you spend hardly anything. So that little hump of spending kind of smooths out your worries on discretionary spending when it comes to discretionary stuff. So we also have, are you going to work in retirement? Do we have concerns about where we're going to pick up health care? And also, you know, changing income needs throughout your retirement years. You have those go-go, slow-go, and no-go. I mean, here's the longevity thing. Now, I'm going to just stick with life expectancy, because to me, longevity risk is, as you guys well know, those that read my book, 2025, The Final Drive, know that I talk about longevity risk as the great risk multiplier. And I borrowed that from Tom Hegna. And the bigger chance, the longer you live, the bigger the chances you could have another stock market crash. You could have inflation eroding purchasing power. You could have taxes destroying your retirement accounts, a long-term care illness, right? So living a long time, there's this multiple of risks that kind of surface. But when you get to age 65, right, or 70 or 75 or 80, you know, you look at percentages, chances of living that long. So when you're 65 years old, there's a 50% chance you'll make it to about 85, 86. There's a 28% chance that you're going to make it to 90, and a 2% chance you'll make it to 100. Now, that's when you reach a 65. But I was talking to someone this week, the older you get, the older they expect you to live, or longer they expect you to live. Inflation, I mean, golly, I was talking to my buddy, we were laughing about gas prices, and gas prices, honestly, right now aren't too bad. I mean, they're hanging in around 310 mm-hmm. with your 87 octane. But I remember being out of Thornton's on 446 heading towards Brown County and scrounging around in my ashtray, which I didn't, we all had ashtrays. I don't, mm-hmm. a lot of cars don't have ashtrays anymore, do they? I don't have
one
of mine.
They do, no.
Man, I was really wanting to smoke on the way home, Doug. Sorry about that. We
well,
you all cracked the window
crack
like
the
my
window.
Mom did
yeah.
when I was
yeah.
a kid. and I'll sit in the front seat as a toddler with no seatbelt on,
exactly
too.
Exactly right.
All right. So, but I made it. I'm still here. But I remember that the gas being like 52 cents a gallon back then. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you go back to 1994, it's about $1.09. They project by 2044, it'll be about $6 a gallon. This is nationally. New home back in 94. That's when I started in business. So that's why I use that number. It was $106,000. In 2044, it's projected to be over $835,000. Back in 19, it was around $380,000 or so. Healthcare costs, like I said, that's been the biggest rider. I mean, when you look between overall inflation, workers' earnings, which have been pretty much the same. I mean, workers' earnings slightly over inflation since 1999, But certainly if you go back into the 60s and 70s, it's not the case. But health insurance premiums are up 239% from 1999. Actually, that's an old number. It's 280% from 1999 to now, whereas workers' earnings are up like 70% from 1999, and overall inflation is up like 60-some percent. So, you know, those are the things you have to keep on top of. Long-term care costs are staggering. Social Security claiming, you know, when is it going to run out? It will be there for me. It will be there for you. I've talked about this so much, right, that in 1984, Reagan signed into law basically to save Social Security. They increased retirement ages. They put taxation on Social Security. They did all kinds of putting delay credits in Social Security, and that firmed it up for a good while. And then when Bill Clinton was in office, he made a couple more adjustments to it. We're going to tax a little bit more on Social Security, right? They did some things so that they could push it out even a little bit further. But I can tell you, when Doug and I first started teaching classes 15 years ago, our retirement planning today, it's been at least 15 years, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
That we were talking about Social Security, and that the administration said by the year 2042, the trust fund will be exhausted and 77 cents for every dollar promised will be paid. And that has just slowly ticked down to now what? To like
2034.
2034. There you go. There you go. So, like I say, guys, whenever the government predicts numbers, they're always wrong, and they're always the wrong way as well. So when it comes to matching expenses and income, kind of be smart about taxes, be smart about longevity, make sure you don't take too much out of your accounts, plan for the unexpected, you know, that's important. And what is the unexpected? Well, that's just it. We don't know. But it's something you got to keep in mind, that there's always got to be that extra money over there just in case. So Doug, the one thing that I like to do is say, okay, well, let's figure out a way to cover whatever it is that you want with some kind of guarantee or contractual income source.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to me, that means contractual is interest on bonds. Income source would be Social Security or pension. And then the third piece would be, do I want to create my own pension by buying an annuity, or just sort of build a bucket plan or whatever it might be, but cover those expenses like that, and make sure that they're in very reliable places. So that kind of dictates your portfolio right there. What's funny is most of the time, if someone comes in, their income and their asset allocation, their income needs and what their asset allocation ends up being is about 60-40.
Yeah.
Almost every single time, which is good. So when I figure it all out, I'm like, oh, we're 58% equities, 42% fixed. That's pretty good. That's 60-40. Isn't that weird how it always turns out that way?
It always goes back to the 60-40, and we remember the 60-40 plan is dead. That kind of came around a couple of years ago, and now all of a sudden it's back in vogue again. You don't read that headline anymore. Listen, investing is personal. Your personal retirement for your household is very unique to you and your household. And so just to read an article or see a paintbrush just go completely across the wall and think, oh, if it's good for them, it's good for me, is one of the bigger mistakes in retirement income planning. Someone may want to have that more traditional view where they transfer a lot of their money over to insurance companies and get annuity stream payments for the rest of their life because they don't want to think about the markets anymore. And if that's okay with them, that's okay with them. Some people would rather be all in the markets, and, you know, guaranteed income or protected income isn't their first objective. It's their second objective. Growth is their first objective. But if you ask one or the other, that might be you and it may not. And so it's very easy to fall into this trap of one size fits all, a broad brush paints a wide, wide strip. That kind of thinking can lead you down a track that doesn't suit you in retirement.
I was trying to look for some numbers, but I'm going to have to go off the top of my head. But I remember seeing the stat that if your married couple make it to 65, there's a 50% chance one of you will make it to 92, and a 25% chance one of you will make it to like 95 or 98. Mm. So when you think about longevity and planning, it's really a family decision, not an individual decision. Social Security is a big one. But it's important because that will help drive your allocation. And when you do that and you have all this money set aside to take care of the things for the next 10 years, let's say, I've got time for markets to recover. They'll go down, right? But they always recover. They may go down and stay down for a while, but they always recover. Mm-hmm. And you give me 10 years, and in almost every case, 10 years later, you're going to have a lot more money by doing it that way. Let's take a quick break, Dougie. And when we come back, the home stretch. It's a great piece. We've had it hanging around the office for a long time. Remember this one from Franklin Templeton?
Oh,
right
yeah.
Here?
Yeah.
The
yeah.
home stretch.
Yeah.
I kind of.
Seven things to do before you retire.
Yeah. So I was
like
going
that.
Through
yeah.
my big pack. Yeah. Pile of crap in my office like I do when I get a whim and to start getting rid of it. And that guy, I've had him on my desk for a long time, and I'm like, you know what? That's something good to talk about.
Yeah.
All right, we'll get to take a break. When we come back, these seven things you need to know the decade before you retire. I'll be right back. It's Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. We were talking off air about the semi-truck that tipped over on Thursday, where it had held 150 pigs at Old 37 and 37. And at the time of the report that I read it, only 64 of the pigs had been recovered that were okay. Not sure how many of the pigs got killed, if any, or how many are running down Smithville Road right now towards Strainridge, where I live. And my son... And we were kind of texting back and forth about it because he's famously known for me going down to Cross, I think, where was it? Somewhere down, way down in Tennessee when he was young, maybe 12 or 13. I just bought him a Ruger 44 long barrel, and he wanted to go hog hunting. So my brother Mark and I, we drive down there, and we go hog hunting.
I remember this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So... We go with a guide and a dog, and we go out and we scout and we find, you know, a herd of pigs, and we decided, okay, the next morning we're going to be getting up daylight. Anyway, we get out there, and a great big, massive boar came barreling by us, like, oh my gosh. So we jump behind a tree, and the dog bays it up, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And Will stands there, look at 24, or his 44 looks down his scope, one shot, not kills that great big boar.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't get it out of the woods. It was so big, so they had to bring in a trailer and a winch and winched it up. They estimated it to weigh like 600 pounds. That's
wow.
How big it was. So we did a shoulder head mount, and it was on his bed. It still is in his bedroom, on the bedroom wall. It's about three quarters over his bed.
Mm-hmm.
So Will's response was hog hunt hog hunt on
How
the south side.
How old was he when you
did that? I think about 12 or 13. So
yeah,
he's 23 now.
I remember that very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember us wanting to rush home on Sunday so I could watch the Colts in the playoffs.
Yeah.
So because it was kind of cold then, but we had a really good time. He'd been asking to go back for a long time. I'm like, dude, you're big enough, old enough now. Get your friends and go down there. I don't have to. Dad doesn't have to go with you anymore. All right. So Dougie, we were talking about this really cool piece that we've had around our office for a long time, called the Home Stretch: Seven Things You Need to Do in the Decade Before You Retire. Now some of these are, you know, just like, hey, pick. You'll know when the time's right. That's what I've talked about every year with my dad. In our annual get-together right around Christmas time when he comes on the show, we kind of recap, you know, what a baby boomer's life has been from his perspective. When do you think you're going to retire? And he retired finally from banking at 77 years old. He fired his real estate company back up. So he's not really retired. But we just said you're just going to know when it's time, and he just knew when it was time. So, but I would say determine when the time is right, or at least think about when you're going to retire. In fact, 46% of people surveyed, and I'm not sure how many people were surveyed. I was, of 2,002 adults comprising of 1,000 men and 1,002 women, 18 years or age or older, so that doesn't really give you any help. Because I don't think you even think about when you're going to retire, probably until you're at least 50-something, right?
Probably not.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, so these may not be any good, but we'll tell you anyway.
Sounds good.
But yeah, sounds good for radio. So 46% of people say that they plan to retire between the ages of 61 and 65. Only 9% of people say between 70 and 74, and 5% between 70 and 79. Had you asked my dad when he was 55, when do you think you're going to retire? He probably would have said 65. But, you know, you get to 65 like that, right? Everyone that's been, I mean, heck, I'm going to be 55. I feel like I just turned 50, and I can't imagine how quick it'll be 60. And that's what I mean. All of a sudden you're there, and you're like, wait a second, I'm not really ready to retire. And understanding, you know, again, couples should plan for age differences as well. We have a lot of clients that are separated by 6 years, 10 years, and sometimes even more. So, you know, the one that's older, especially if it's a higher income earner, probably going to have to work longer because they're going to have to plan for that other person. Important ages, of course, we have 50, 55, 59 and a half, 62, 67, 70, 73, 75. Of course, all those different ages are catch-up contributions. Early, you can take penalty-free distributions if you terminate service at 55 from your qualified plan. Age 60, widow's benefits. 59 and a half, insert, you know, you can take money out of an IRA without a penalty. 62, early retirement benefits from Social Security. 66 to 67, full retirement age for Social Security. 70, maximum Social Security. 73 or 75, required minimum distributions. Man, they make it complicated, Husey.
I know. And you know, the thing is, David, all these different gadgets and levers and dates, they actually serve a purpose, and that's to get people to make a decision or force them to do something, when the reality is, what if you just stepped back away from all of it and said, I'm going to retire when I'm going to retire. I'm going to put a plan together that's going to let me choose what I want to do when I want to do it.
That's right.
But the government is so involved now and so pointed in what they want you to do at certain times or what they don't want you to do before a certain
time. Right,
right. Very few people just take a step back and say, as Frank Sinatra famously saying, I'll do it my way.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. I'm looking at people who are always like, well, how much do I need to save? Well, most people, we go by a net income approach. Like, we don't care what your gross is, because with gross income, I mean, everybody's saving differently. Some people have dues, some people don't. I mean, when it comes to retirement, you pay two types of taxes, state and local and federal. Federal, state, and local income taxes. That's it. There's no more FICA. There's no more 401k contributions. There's no more of this and no more of that. So we look at it that way. And what's interesting is it always usually comes back to about 70 to 80% of your gross income, which we've been following that rule of thumb for decades. So about 70%. If you think about it, if you look at what your gross and what your take home is, most people are bringing home about 68% of their gross. That's, to me, is about right, especially if you've been maxing out your 401k. So again, back into those things. Estimate your retirement expenses. Take some time the year before you retire and write down your housing expenses. Write down what's going to be coming up with the house. Is it you see an HVAC unit in your future? Do you see a new roof in your future? Think about the necessities. Think about health care, transportation, taxes, debts, all that kind of stuff needs to be taken into consideration. Let me give you a rule of thumb that I don't know if it's really great, but it's okay. If you take your age, then how much should you have in retirement? So the one that I ran across that I think is probably pretty close, if you're age 50 and you're making 100 grand a year, you should probably have 55 to 6 times that in your retirement, so 500 to 600,000. If you're my age, 55, and you make $100,000, probably between 6 and 8 times. So about 600 to 800,000. If you're 65 years old, you should probably have between 10 and 12 times your salary. So if you make 100 grand and you're 65, you should have between $1 million and $1.2 million in your retirement account. So if I just told you that and you said, oh my gosh, I'm not even close, or oh my gosh, I'm way ahead, let's talk about the oh my gosh, I'm not even close people. What do you do about it? Well, you make more on your investments. You save more, or you retire later. It's really that simple. So you don't have to be a mathematician to figure that one out. Let's see here, Duggar. We got maximize your nest egg, get a portfolio checkup. I have you comment on a couple of these because I'm not going to go over all of them because
sure.
Some of them aren't that great. But creating a Social Security strategy, building that retirement income plan, and I like this one, kind of looking beyond the money, because I've been telling people over and over who aren't spending a lot of money because that's just not the way they're wired. I'm like, come on, man. Create memories, not money. Create more memories, not money. And those that follow that advice typically come back and say, man, I'm so glad that we did that. But
absolutely,
you got to look beyond the money.
Looking beyond the money. It's interesting. This morning, David, I read, yesterday afternoon, this morning, I've been reading the interviews, the feedback from the people who took Royal Caribbean's first 9-month round the world cruise, 274 days on the cruise ship. And it was interesting. They interviewed young people who could work remotely. They interviewed wealthy people, and they interviewed regular retirees, all different backgrounds, decided to abandon their normal life and go on a 9-month cruise around the world. The end of the story is this. Every one of them felt like they had a brand new community. Everyone felt like it was living, not vacationing. Every one of them wanted to pass their ideas along to everyone they could talk to about thinking not just about money, but about memories. And so it's interesting we're talking about this right now because it is absolutely true. At some point, you do think beyond the money. Now, the money does dictate what you're thinking, right?
Yeah.
But you do need to think beyond the money. There's a great book called The Art of Spending Money. There's so many books out there about how to save money, how to be wealthy, how to do this, how to do that. But few people teach you actually how to spend money and that it's okay to spend money. And these are ways you can feel good about spending money. And so when we talk to people, as you know, we say this to people, make memories.
Yeah.
Make memories.
Why make more money? Make memories.
Yeah.
I mean, I was talking a lot about this a while ago, but don't live that just in case retirement. You know, I'm not going to buy that new bass boat because, you know, just in case. I'm not going to. Yeah. Are you kidding me? I'm going to join that golf club. No, it's too expensive. I'm just, you know, because just in case, I'm not going to spend that kind of money to go to Florida for 3 months, you know, because there's just in case.
Mm-hmm.
Are you kidding me? That my car's fine. I don't need to buy a new car.
Yeah.
Because just in case. Then you die. And your kids go to Florida. They buy the boats. They buy the trucks. They do all the things that you didn't do because of that just-in-case retirement, and they're doing it on you. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back and wrap it up. It's Your Money with David Hayes. All right, thanks to Kenny Blaine Auctions. They are your full-service auction service. Good friends of mine offering the pre-planning the sale of your estate or real estate. Give them a call or go online, KennyBlaineAuctions.com. Lance Lyke, he's got some great commercials, Lance. I keep telling you that. At the Lyke Law Group, give yourself and your family the peace of mind that comes with proper estate planning. So, Lance, maybe you should write a new card and give it to me, or I'll just write my own. Lance Lyke at the Lyke Law Group, 812-323-8300. All right, so Doug and I will be off to Austin, Texas tomorrow morning. We'll be back in studio next week. The following week will be the crew taking over for me while I'm in Tanzania. I'm taking my brother. I was going to take my dad, but dad wasn't quite up for it, he said. So I'm taking my brother, my younger brother, Mark. And he's wild and crazy, and it'll be a lot of fun with him there. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Looking forward to getting away for a little bit. But don't worry about our office. They runs as well
absolutely
with us or without
maybe
us.
Maybe even better without
maybe
us.
Maybe even better without us. So it's going to be a good one. And I hope everyone has a great rest of the week and weekend. And I'll talk to you next week, everybody. Bye-bye.
The preceding program was brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities.